listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Just to confess, I could not sleep last night. I was a complete insomniac, so at 4 in the morning, I just thought, what the hell, I'll get up and I'll read. And the book I turned to was Charles Bowden's Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's an extraordinary book. The writing literally zings off the page. The reporting is precise and brave and hallucinatory. Do I recommend it for an insomniac? No. Do I recommend it? Absolutely. As Charles Bowden makes clear, Juarez's culture of violence, will not only worsen, but will inevitably spread north. Charles Bowden is one of the few journalists brave enough to spend extended periods of time, over 15 years, in Juarez. He's written an account that is both brilliant and disturbing of a total collapse of civic society and the ability of the state to protect its citizens. With a murder rate that exceeds that of Baghdad, 1,607 people were murdered there in 2008 alone. The city has disintegrated into a culture of violence. In this new way of life, no one is really in charge, writes Bowden, and no one is safe. The violence has crossed class lines. The violence is everywhere. It has no apparent and simple source. It is like the dust in the air, part of life itself. The recipient of a Lannan Literary Award for nonfiction and the Sidney Hillman Award, Charles Bowden is a critically acclaimed author of many books, including Down by the River, A Shadow in the City, and Some of the Dead Are Still Breathing. He is a contributing editor of GQ and Mother Jones Magazine and writes for many other publications such as Harper's, New York Times Book Review, Esquire, and Aperture. In conversation with Charles Bowden tonight, we are very fortunate to have Adolfo Guzman Lopez, who has been a full-time reporter with Southern California Public Radio, KPCC 89.3 FM, one of Aloud's media partners since 2000. He's reported on education, politics, and culture, and his work has been recognized by the regional Edward R. Murrow LA Press Club Radio Journalist of the Year and the Ruben Salazar Awards. He began his journalism career in Tijuana and San Diego. In fact, the last program that he moderated for us was an eye-opening panel with journalists from Tijuana who report on the violence there. We're very fortunate to have him as our interlocutor tonight. Please join me in welcoming Charles Bowden and Adolfo Guzman Lopez. Thank you very much.
Got it. Okay, is that where the Grand Inquisitor sits?
Yeah. The bullfighter and the bull.
Well, I think you left a word off bull, but I won't fill it in. I'll let the audience use their imagination.
Well, Charles, for me, after reading the book, to understand, I could relate to the book. I grew up in Tijuana, reported in San Diego and Tijuana, and had a chance to follow some Border Patrol agents right there on the línea. They did a drug bust. Actually, the big bricks of I don't remember whether it ended up being marijuana or what were in the back seat, and there were all kinds of stickers, evangelical Christian stickers on the car. The way they found out, or the tip, what led them to inspect that car, was that the woman, the female driver, her vein was like pumping, and so they stopped it. So that's one of the stories I did. To understand this book, I'm thinking to myself, because I've been in LA for a while, what if a lieutenant with the Pasadena Police Department was gunned down with his kid? What if a whole division from Camp Pendleton ended up working for the Bloods and the Crips? What if a LA Times reporter was unemployed because he wouldn't take money from the Avenues gangs? You know, that, to me, that's what just changed the agency names, and that's what's happening in Ciudad Juarez. That's the world they're living in, right?
And increasingly much of Mexico. You know, it's systemic. That Americans, and particularly American policymakers, like to imagine we have to fix things by an adjustment. We will send experts down, like Giuliani went down there, and they will give a few lectures on security and police, and then it's fine. It reminds me of a conversation, not on Mexico, but on Iraq, I had with Senator John McCain in his office in the summer of 2002. And he said, Chuck, look, we can change Iraq into a parliamentary democracy in less than 5 years. And I remember leaning forward, because I'm a friendly guy, and saying, will you share your drugs? And he sincerely believed it, you know, because he thought these cultures were plastic. Now we have Secretary Clinton, Secretary Napolitano, a whole plane full of people you pay for, flew to Mexico City and said we're going to help them with their justice system. As if, you know, they're illiterates and have never read about other legal systems. I mean, you know, this is preposterous. But the example you give is realistic. How would the people in this audience react if they lived in that reality? People come up to me and tell me cops are corrupt in Chicago. I spent part of my childhood and adulthood there. It's true. But it isn't like Juarez. Yeah.
One of the things that you do really well is you paint portraits of the people that you meet there, and that's who we meet along the way. I'd like you to read the prologue, which is a really good setup to this trip that you take.
That's kind. I always like a prologue that's a good setup. You know?
Jeffrey Chaucer did a good job, didn't he?
Okay, here's the deal. We're going to take us a ride. Now be quiet. Time's up. You got a ride. We brought the duct tape. Do you prefer gray or tan? No matter. Get your ass in. We got the plastic bag, the loaded guns. You've been waiting? Everyone is waiting. But our list is so long. Everybody pretends we will never come. But everyone is on somebody's list. Well, for you, the wait's over. Let me tell you about a killing season. What? You don't like violence? I understand. But get in the car. You say it is hard to see because of the darkly tinted windows? You learn darkness. Miss Sinaloa is a detail. She was special, so fine. Of course, she took the ride. My God, what a ride. Okay, yes, there is the matter of cocaine and whiskey and sanity that might undercut her standing in the community. See those people on the street pretending you don't exist? And this big machine with tinted windows doesn't exist? Pretending that none of this is happening to you? That was you until just a few minutes ago. Now, 14 people were executed in Juarez yesterday. It isn't on the news here. They never existed. It never happened. Except to them. There you go. I love crib sheets. You know. Thank you.
Charles, who is Miss Sinaloa?
Miss Sinaloa is actual. In my past, I have many pasts. I covered sex crimes for daily paper for 3 years. I quit 3 times. The third time I succeeded, I broke down. And you never use the name of a victim of rape. But I know her name. She was actual. She came. They grow beauty queens like trees in Sinaloa. All the drug guys want their girlfriend to be a beauty queen. So they have lots of contests, and guess who wins? You know? She won a beauty contest. She was invited to a big private party in Juarez. She flew in. Nice-looking woman. And she goes to the party, and she's raped for 3 days and 3 nights by the police. And she has scars on her breasts and everything, and she loses her mind. I think that's the reason she's alive, why she wasn't just killed. That insanity you know, sort of spook them. So they took her out to a place on the edge of the city, an insane asylum built by a man named El Pastor Jose Antonio Galban. He is a former drug addict in Juarez, a large man. He'd lived on the streets. He'd heard the call to Jesus. He'd moved out there with a burro in the sand and started building an asylum for people like himself. So he takes everyone in. He has 100, 120 people there. There's no water. There's not really electricity. There's no medicine. I donate money and other people do to feed these people. These are people who will never come back. Their brains have been destroyed by glue, by beatings. There's go-go dancers out there and lap dancers who are out of their skull. They are the scars of what the city can do to people.
What does the facility look like? Are these?
It's a big walled thing built by him, by hand. It's not quite Frank Lloyd Wright. Yeah. And he's got a knight in shining armor on it because that's his vision. And he's got cells for the really violent people before he detoxes them, which he's made out of rebar and welded. He prays for me to save my soul, and he's building a cell for me, he tells me, because he said, you will come here eventually. He takes care of Miss Sinaloa, and she slowly comes back. And she falls in love with a crazy guy there and thinks God has let this happen to her so she would meet this guy. And then her family comes. He finds her family, El Pastor, in Sinaloa. They come and take her away. Now, I used her in the—I don't really like metaphors because I can never remember the definition. They're not similes, though. My God, I remember getting hit. She becomes, for me, what the city does. People come there. This city for 40 years has recruited the poor to work in American factories, to have the American dream. And these people, most of them have been destroyed. Since the early to mid-80s, the wages in the American-owned factories, which are called maquiladoras, have in constant pesos or dollars declined. You know, and now Juarez has lost 100,000 jobs because these greedy devils and these factories are getting paid four times what the Chinese pay. So 100,000 jobs went to China. Forbes published this. The problem with Mexico is the wages are too high. The wages in Juarez in a factory, if you get a job, are $45 to $75 a week. The turnover is 100 to 200% a year. The cost of living is 90% of what it is in the U.S. Do the math. You want the job? We can help you.
At one point, you say that in talking about the murders of women, the femicides, as they're known now, that there are more men killed than women.
Oh, far more. Look, this is like a sidetrack. I expect to be stoned to death. In one of my earlier lives, I was Dr. Frankenstein. In order to draw attention to the city in 1995 or 6, I wrote a story about the treatment of women there called While You Were Sleeping. It created a kind of odd academic cottage industry about femicides. Now, I won't address that. It's also created 17 films. You know, the murder rate of Juarez in Juarez of women is the same as in Mexico. If you go basically anywhere in Mexico, it's 10% of the homicides are female. It's gone down to 6% now in Juarez. There was a bump in the mid-90s of young girls working in the factories being kidnapped, raped, and murdered. As you know, in statistics, there's always bumps. No one on earth has ever had the median income in a city. That's the aggregate divided. And then it went away again. And this has become an issue with a lot of feminist scholars. And they say two things. Now they're saying 800 women have been murdered since 93, which I believe is true. What they don't say is two-thirds to three-quarters of them, if you look in the statistical records, were killed by husbands and lovers.
So what are you saying, though? Are you saying that just focusing on that does a disservice to the entire
violence?
I'll
tell you what they're doing. There's 5,000 dead people there, and they're focusing on a handful of homicides.
Did you run
there are people living in misery, fully employed by American factories, and they're looking at a handful of homicides.
Did you run into any of those activists while you were in Juarez?
Yeah, one of the greatest activists there died Christmas morning at 6 a.m., Esther Chavez Cano, and she was a friend of mine. I'm a guy who didn't have a tree Christmas Day. I shut down my life and sat alone for 2 days. That woman created the only shelter in Juarez for women out of her own mind. It treats 30,000 women a year now who have been raped and beaten. I mean, good God, she's a saint to me. She was a friend. So the issue isn't that. The issue is what people should do is look at the city. There's 5,000 dead there in less than 3 years. 95% are males. A bunch of children has been killed. In the last 3 years, Juarez has created 10,000 orphans. This city is dying. 10,000 businesses have closed, 40% of the businesses. 25% of the houses have been abandoned. 30,000 to 60,000 rich people have fled to El Paso. There were 2,660 murders in 2009. There were 30 arrests. And I'm supposed to tell you why they haven't solved the murder of some women? They don't solve any murders. They don't solve the murders of children. They don't solve the murders of men. You know, everybody dies, and that's the end of it.
Tell me about Esther Chavez.
I'll be calm now.
Tell me about Esther
Give
Chavez.
Give me my meds.
Esther Chavez Cano, how did she get to what she was doing, the shelter for battered women, and what exactly was she doing?
I love telling the story. Esther Chavez, about the same time I noticed, is reading the Mexican newspapers there, and she starts noticing these killings of girls. And one reason it struck her in the eye why it was new was these factories were suddenly recruiting girls to the city, 15, 16, 17-year-old girls. They're 500 miles from their family. They've never been away from their family. They're walking home at 2 a.m. because the factories run three shifts a day, and they don't give you valet service to your hut. And these women are getting bagged because do you seriously think if it's 2 a.m. and you think, I just want to be mean, you're going to take a guy like me who's 6'4", somebody who weighs 98 pounds, barely 5 feet? You know, they're easy prey. And so I'm clipping it, and she's clipping it. That's why I wrote the story. But unlike me, Esther hit the ceiling. She had moved there to take care of her dying aunt. She was a retired account executive from Kraft, Mexico. She liked to listen to classical music. And she said, I won't take this. And so then she starts petitioning the city. She's putting up posters. You know, she builds a cross and hangs ribbons for each dead girl. And then she thinks, you know, what people need here are help. The women start coming to her. And this shelter isn't some shack. She's got doctors there and nurses. She travels all over the world giving speeches. She creates the first care for battered women in northern Mexico, period. You know, the reason these people, Miss Sinaloa was taken to El Pastor, a strange place in the desert, is there is no other care. There is no safety net. Well, Esther created it. And frankly, I'll interject my pitch for my book. One of my obsessions, now that she's dead and created this one place of succor, is to keep it going. I went out the last year of her life and raised $150,000 to keep it going. This is the best. It's called Casa Amiga. It has a website. It's casamiga.com. If you want to bang for your buck, and we all like that, this is worth it. It's direct help for helpless people. Okay. We'll go back to pitching the book now.
Charles, what's it like to be a female police officer in Ciudad Juarez?
Well, it depends. You know, there were complaints in early 2008. My friend, Julian Cardona, who photographed the stuff in there. He's out at night taking photos, and three city policemen have been kidnapped by the army and raped. That's part of the problem. By May of 2008, there's a police demonstration. Of course, they all wear masks to protect their identity. beseeching the government to intercede so the army will stop kidnapping them and torturing them. You know, that's what it's like. You know, there is no center anymore to violence in Juarez. There was a wonderful time when the Juarez cartel kind of ran the city, and you could at least pick up a phone and say, don't kill me. Now there's 500 to 900 street gangs. You got the Mexican army there, 8 to 10,000 rampaging. You got 5,000 federal police rampaging. You have all these police forces, and there's nobody to call.
There's another part that I'd like you to read, and it's about one of those female police officers. I think she's a administrative director, right?
Well, let me see if I can. Okay, God, I like this. Where do I start? She is 40?
Yeah.
Okay. She's 40 years old and probably worries about the coming years taxing her face and her body. Maybe she thinks of Botox treatments. No matter now. She has full red lips, hair to her shoulders, a white blouse and a dark coat, and a necklace gleams at her throat. She is the administrative director of the Juarez Police Department. She had worked in the department from 2002 to 2005, left, and then returned in October 2007. Technically, her job put her in charge of human resources. She lives in a very nice neighborhood, and at about 10:23 p.m. on Monday, June 16th, she is murdered in front of her home. A sign thoughtfully left with her corpse explains that she had hired too many people associated with El Chapo Guzman, the head of the Sinaloa cartel. Her name is Silvia Guzman Molina. Now she becomes a new woman. Before her murder, she was law enforcement, and by the standard of the city, an innocent. But having been assassinated, she now becomes dirty, someone who must have been connected to bad people doing bad things. The police department says she was doing an adequate job, and that is why they are surprised she has been slaughtered. Juarez has these little mysteries about the dead. Given the standard that the dead are dirty and the living are innocents, clearly the heads of the major cartels in Mexico are innocents. Since this massive drug war began at the behest of the president of Mexico, they have not had a hair on their heads touched. Also, the killers moving around Juarez with machine guns and big SUVs have also suffered few, if any, deaths. So clearly they're also innocents.
Now, Charles, my point of reference for the role of the media is Tijuana Zeta newspaper and Jesus Blanco Ornelas, who, you know, over a span of about 25, 30 years, wrote about drug trafficking, wrote about corruption in Tijuana.
Took some bullets.
Took some bullets, survived. I think one of his bodyguards didn't. And in the beginning of his career, he actually had to go into San Diego, published his newspaper there because the city officials closed his printing operation. What's the role of newspapers and reporters in Ciudad Juarez? How many dailies are there, weeklies, the radio news stations, and what are they reporting?
Look, there's three dailies, you know, there's weeklies, there's radio, TV. What they're reporting is less and less, and I'll tell you why. It's dangerous. They're doing far more than the American press. The American press basically reports Juarez with binoculars, you know, from the U.S. side. But the book is dedicated to a dead reporter. After he was killed, bylines started disappearing on murders. The publisher of the Major Juarez Daily lives in El Paso for his own security reasons. So what you have is a suborned press. And in other parts of the border, it's worse. Like in Nuevo Laredo, they don't report anything about drug killings, period. Because somebody thoughtfully visited their newsroom, machine gunned some people, and then threw in a grenade in case they didn't understand. You know, they've killed people all along the border. The Mexican press has always had its problems. It's always been manipulated. It's always gotten bribes for politicians not to cover things, et cetera. But its coverage of this war is going to be the only significant coverage.
And at some point...
A friend of mine and I have amassed 4,000 to 5,000 articles from the Mexican press to archive. about Juarez since this violence started. And the reason we've done it, it'll disappear down there, you know, like vaporware. And we want to archive it in the United States so someday the Mexican people will have access to what happened to them. That's it.
One of the clips you include in the appendix is, I don't know if it's a headline or just the lead paragraph, it says that we have the nickname of the killer. We have the nickname.
Well, look at
the nickname.
You have to understand the Mexican justice system. There's an excellent documentary that was made by a Mexican national getting a PhD in Berkeley 2 years ago, Presumed Guilty. 93% of the people convicted of a felony never see a judge or an arrest warrant. They're convicted with no physical evidence. I could go, you know, that this is a processing factory. You're tried in camera. You know what I mean? Sometimes you're just told you've been convicted. You don't even go to court, et cetera, et cetera. This is not a justice system, as people here have an expectation when they hear the phrase. This is a system to keep down the poor.
But it goes beyond
social
that.
Social control.
Doesn't it go beyond that, though? I mean, don't some news reports, and you write about it in the book, some news reports actually are coded messages to some of the cartels.
It's like tea leaf reading, you know, the Mexican press. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's knowing, like La Jornada years ago under the Salinas years, the left of center daily in Mexico City, would print stories the government bought with italics headlines as a clue, you know, that they'd paid for propaganda. Yes, it's, say, armed commandos. Depending on the circumstance, it means they think the military did the hit, that kind of thing. Emilio Gutierrez, a friend of mine, now a refugee in the United States because a reporter of the Mexican army desired to kill, learned how to do elaborate codes, but they weren't elaborate enough, so they came to kill him. He's seeking political asylum here. What I'm trying to establish is it's a little murky reading the press, but it's far more revealing than the American press. The American press is still going to Juarez after 5,000 corpses, most of them poor people, and proudly announcing it's a cartel war. The American press is still saying after 23,000 Mexicans have been slaughtered and less than 100 soldiers that it's a cartel war. They just don't care if there's any dead cartel people.
What's your opinion of the reporters you did run into, the U.S. reporters you did run into in Juarez, and the work they were doing, or the challenges, or how prepared?
Well, look, I'll be honest, kind of. I didn't run into them in Juarez. They would come and visit me on this side. And, you know, what I tried to do was give them my sources and tell them what I was seeing. I wanted to change the focus of the story. The one thing, I hate the phrase, the war against drugs. There is nobody in this country that has missed their fix of drugs because of this war. I know of no place where there's been an explosion in price because of this war. The drugs are arriving on time. The drugs are an enormous source of real money in Mexico. I'll give you an example. I think in 2003 or 4 in the federal budget, the Mexican army was down for $4 billion. In 1995, the Juarez cartel was earning $250 million a week, $12 billion a year. Mexico has depleting oil fields, which the president says will run out in 9 years. Who knows? It's 40% of the budget. The drug industry is earning $30 to $50 billion. That's probably as much as oil does. Do you seriously think there's an effort to shut down the drug industry? It's like saying, I have a headache. I'm going to get a chainsaw and cut my head off. This isn't going to happen. They're dependent. The United States knows this. The United States is financing a charade so you people are placated. We're dealing with the problem. It's a variation of the wall. We're dropping billions to build a wall as if we can actually wall out people. If you think it works, you know, you should go study the Mongol emperors of China after the Chinese built the wall. I could go on and on that. We have a policy that's not reality-based. We have lost the war on drugs, and what defeated us was our own people. There's a phrase politicians use, the pusher. You know, somehow people come into your life. I know you're all good people. And apparently they force-feed you drugs like a goose for Christmas. Well, that's a bunch of bullshit. What people in this country do is frantically drive into strange neighborhoods looking for drugs. There's no there's no billboards out there on the freeway. You know, this is a market. You can't repeal a market economy.
In the book, you make the distinction between clean, not clean, honest, and dishonest.
I get tired of this. Yeah, the common thing people ask me, if some Mexicans clean, is the cop clean, is the reporter clean? The society is essentially lubricated by little transactions, you know. The cops don't get paid enough not to take bribes, you know. They look like anorexics. What somebody, like a clean cop, is somebody who doesn't frame you, you know, that doesn't kill you, doesn't set you up. Actually, it's the same ethic I learned in Chicago. I was raised there. No, I mean it, that I have the privilege of being put in a cell when I was 7 by the Chicago police. I decided to learn how to play golf by using the windows in the public school as the hole-in-one. And the reporters, a lot of Mexican reporters get sobres, payments. Well, they don't get enough money anyway. And then a lot of the money is so you don't report something, you know. But that doesn't mean they're a bunch of crooks or something. They're in a system. And that's the way the system works. In Chicago, when I was a kid, if you needed something done by your alderman, you didn't write him a letter. I had a friend raising a child. This was in the 70s, and a brothel moved in across the street, and he thought, this is not a good environment. So he goes down to see the alderman and says, look, I've got a whorehouse across the street from where I'm raising children. And Alderman Mel says, I'll fix it. Here's $500 worth of tickets to my spaghetti dinner. Sell them. Of course, you had to buy them first.
You mentioned Emilio Gutierrez, and he's one of the honest.
Well, what he did was
Could you read something that talks about a visit paid to Emilio Gutierrez?
Yeah, here, let me see if I can. There's so many words in this book, I can't always find things. I mean, geez, they're on every page.
One after the other, right?
Okay, which part would you like me to read?
On January and
30th. Oh, okay. Okay. On January 29th, 2005, 6 soldiers came to the hotel across the street, took food off people's plates, and robbed the customers of their money and jewelry. Emilio gets calls in Ascension, and so he phoned the local police chief and the manager of the hotel. He called the army also, but as is its custom, the army refused to answer any questions from the press. Then he filed a brief article about the incident, one of 3 he wrote in that period, noting similar actions by the army in the area. That is how he destroyed his life. Late on the night of February 8th of the same year, Colonel Martinez called Gutierrez at home and explains that he is the boss and orders him to come immediately to the Hotel Miami in downtown Ascension. Emilio explains that he's getting ready for bed and some other time could be better. The colonel says, if you don't come, we'll come looking for you at home or wherever you are. So Emilio puts his then 12-year-old son in his truck and goes there. He notices 50 soldiers in the 4-block area around the hotel and 2 vans full of bodyguards for the officers. He leaves his son in the truck and walks up to the officer. It's a very cold night. In his mind, he's thinking, what the fuck are those cabrones up to? Soldiers suddenly surround him. He's in front of the Hotel Miami, but he's in solitary confinement. The colonel says to another officer, look, General, the son of a whore who has written all kinds of stupidities has arrived. The general, Garcia Vega, says, so you're the son of the whore who is slowly lowering our prestige. You son of a fucking whore, you're denigrating us. And my boss, the minister in Mexico City, is extremely bothered by your lies, idiot. Emilio feels very small. He cannot think of a way to escape his fate. He tries to form words to excuse himself, but he can't. The general is in charge of all of Chihuahua. He's short, and his uniform is brilliant with gold trim. Emilio is very frightened, and he says that he only writes what the officials or the victims tell him. The general says, "No, you have no sources for that information. You made it up. Just how much schooling do you have, asshole?" Emilio lies and claims 2 years of communication study in the university. The general explains that Emilio lacks an education equal to his own. To have a general speak to you is not something to be desired. They can hand out death like a party favor. The general suggests that he should write about drug people. Emilio says he does not know any. Besides, they frighten him. "So you don't know them and you fear them," the general bristles. "You should fear us, for we fuck the fucking drug traffickers, you son of a whore. I feel like putting you in the van and taking you to the mountains so you can see how we fuck over drug traffickers, assholes." Now, here's the point. You're going to say that this guy is not an honest reporter because he trims his accounts to stay alive. There isn't anybody in the American press dealing with that. I am the American press, that I don't have a right to judge this guy. And what he does to survive is he just stops writing anything except stories about fiestas and All Saints Day or something, because he wants to live to raise his son.
Is that what ends up happening to him?
Well, they come back. For 3 years, he writes nothing. Then the president of Mexico says, "We have to have a surge." You're familiar with that term. Floods the zone with even more army. Emilio notices his house is being watched. But at first he thinks, "They're not really watching my house. Next door is a grocery store where they sell cocaine, and that's why the soldiers are here, because they're always going in and buying cocaine." Then later that day he gets a tip from an old girlfriend. She says, "Look, I'm involved with some of the soldiers, and they're going to kill you. You have to leave." And that's when he gets in his car, and he drives to the U.S. border pell-mell with his son, and he goes to Antelope Wells, New Mexico, which is a legal port of entry in the boot heel of New Mexico. And like everyone else coming across the border customs, ICE, Homeland Security, says, "What do you bring?" And Emilio Gutierrez says, "We bring fear." And so they throw him in prison for 7 months. And they throw his son in prison for 2 months because they say he could be a menace to our community. And he will, if he gets political asylum, he'll be the first reporter in the history of the country to get political asylum in this country, because that would be an admission that the Mexican government isn't exactly like ours, that all that happened, you know. And he has an excellent lawyer. His case comes up January 2011. And the reason he came and said we bring fear is he spent the night before he left on a little computer researching our human rights treaties. And he thought, you know, under these treaties, he thought this country will protect me. He didn't know how to read between the lines in our writing.
You spend a lot of time talking about truth. There's a place called Shadowland, which is, this occasional glimpse of truth, where people start talking about truth and then they step back. I mean, for me, I suppose this isn't just particular Mexican culture, but you know, we all have stories in our family, and when the adults start talking about the truth when you're present, and then they don't, and then your appetite is whetted. I mean, you want to know what the truth is, but you don't hear about that child out of wedlock. You don't hear about in my particular family, one of my uncles just found out about 4 or 5 years ago that the mother that raised him isn't really his mother. His mother died, and his mother's sister raised him. You talk about the nature of truth. What is Shadowland?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example, since I only do perfect things. When Emilio is 10 years old, there's a real pretty girl in school, Rosa. She's called the Little Devil. She's about 13. And, you know, he's younger, but all the kids, you know, she's the beautiful young girl. And the army's in the town where he's raised in Chihuahua. And they find her body on the edge of town, naked, covered with mud, dead. And they bring the car in, it's found in, into the town. He's going to school, and he walks by with the other kids, and there's a classmate, dead, been raped, her breasts have been slashed. And everybody in that town knows the army did it. Every child, every adult, and no one says it out loud. That's his first lesson. His parents talk politics, but nobody really says out loud what everybody in that school has basically witnessed, and the police do nothing. And that's the kind of reality you live with. It's similar to when you read accounts of the Soviet Union, where you know things but don't know them. You keep them in some sort of suspended state, because actually grasping them and saying the truth upsets your world and puts you in danger.
What do the Mexican reporters think about those American reporters who come and look for the documents and look for the facts and look for confirmation?
They think they're fools. They think they're idiots. I'm an American reporter, and I've had this carefully explained to me, Chuck. What they think is that American reporters come there with assumptions and don't want to know how Mexico really is. What they think is they treat them like children and tell them what they want to hear, but they don't really tell them what they're thinking. What they think is they're deliberately naive. What they think is apparently American reporters can look at an official war against drug cartels where the Mexican army is fighting the cartel and there's 23,000 dead Mexicans and 100 dead soldiers and not question it. What they think is the Mexican reporters can report in the press, and you can check this, they'll do it constantly, how the war on drugs in Mexico is disturbing the cartels, rattling their operation, costing them money, and never have the energy to walk out of a news office and ask a junkie how the prices are and the availability in their town. What they think is they're gutless idiots. They're slowly convincing me.
You must drive the fact-checking department at the publisher crazy.
I encourage them to use drugs on my books. So. Look, there aren't hard facts. I'll give you an example. I said there's 2,753 people who were killed in the city of Juarez in 2009. That's from the Chihuahuan government. There is no record of the people that disappeared, which were hundreds, and most of the people that disappear never come back. They're just slaughtered. We don't know the dead. The army periodically goes, whoa, and finds us what they call a secret burying ground. You know, we don't know if the army buried the people. One of the characters in the book is a professional killer, a sicario. He was trained, hired by the cartel, went through the police academy, became the commander of the anti-kidnapping unit in Juarez, and of course his business was kidnapping people and killing them and collecting ransom. He had like a 20-year run. I mean, this is a strange kind of reality you live in, and it's Mexicans know it. They have a hard time acknowledging it. I had a friend there who was raised in a very rough barrio. It was all heroin. He came up straight. This happens. He had cameras. Well, it's the guy who, my friend, who photographed all, took all these pictures that I work with. And one day he comes home, and he lives like, you know, under lock and key. He normally keeps at least a 150-pound dog around that doesn't like human beings. And all his cameras are stolen. And he says, this is terrible, you know, I don't have any money. So he goes to the police. My cameras are stolen. And they say, well, you'll have to give us $500 to get him back. And then he suddenly comes to his senses that nobody could steal the cameras without working with the police. And that, you know, he's slipped into this delusional state where he thinks he lives in a city where there's real police. And then he just goes home. You know, it's hopeless. you know, that now people slip into that. I'll give you an example from my own dementia. I never believed in the war in Iraq, but in the ramp up, even though I was reading Blixen and all these reports from the UN inspectors, I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that all the major newspapers said there were weapons of mass destruction. The entire government said there were weapons of mass destruction. I didn't believe my government, but some part of my mind thought there must be. How could all these people be saying that? I had entered the same state my friend did when he went to the police. I'm slowly being cured of it. What bothers me about the way the war on drugs is covered in Mexico and in this country is it is not fact-based. I don't know what's going on. I'll tell one more little story, just a tiny one. I just read this. April, in the spring of 2008, a Juarez businessman was murdered. He left two stepchildren who were 16, 17. On April 14th, the family then sort of moved to El Paso. It's not a bad sign when they're killing you, a good sign. On April 14th, the daughter, the stepdaughter, drove over to Juarez to see the grandmother who had stayed. She disappeared. On April 20th, her brother, who's 1 year older, went over to Juarez to try and find her. He was machine gunned, and then they found her body on the outside of the city. Now, I can't explain those three murders, nor will anyone. That's what happens. They will never be investigated except in a sham way. An entire family has been slaughtered. The only thing I know is there's a reason for all three deaths. But you can't say, oh, the cartel did it. You can't say the police did it. You can't say the army did it. A lot of people could have killed them. The only thing you can say with certainty is whoever killed them is never going to be brought to justice.
Before we move to the Q&A, in the book, you talk about death as being the only hard fact. And the killings are committed by the sicarios, the hitmen.
Some of them.
You sit down with one of them. How did that happen?
I called in a big favor. I've been going in and out of the city. I'm having a drink with this guy I've known very well. I've done favors for him. He tells me he's sheltering a sicario, a contract killer. This guy's killed 500 or 600 people. And there's $250,000 contract on this guy's head. And I said, I want a favor. I want to talk to him. I won't reveal his name. But I have been around these guys now for 20 years off and on. And I finally want one of them to talk to me and tell me who the hell they are and what they're doing and why. That's the deal. And I will protect his identity. You know, I will never reveal it. And so that's why the guy talked to me, because he was ordered to by the guy who was sheltering him from contract killers who were looking for him. Now, this is not abstract. He had two problems, the sicario. The Juarez cartel had $250,000 contract, and anybody that killed them gets $250,000. At the same time, the Sinaloa cartel is trying to find him because they want to hire him to kill the Juarez cartel. And so, you know, he has lots of people that want to meet him. You know? And so we talked initially for 2 days, and then, look, this has been going on for a year now, basically. And he told me everything, meaning once he started talking, he couldn't stop. Because, if your business is killing people and torturing people and cutting them up, you don't get to give a lot of speeches at the Rotary. You don't talk to your wife about it. And so he talked, and I wrote it down, and I put it in the book, and that's why. That I wanted an explanation. The interesting thing was, after I did that, I got these angry emails from friends. I published a small version of his life in Harper's Magazine. How could I talk to him? I don't understand that. If it was 1944 and I had a chance to sit down with Hitler, I would. I'd want to know what the hell's going on. Who are you and why are you doing this? So I did, maybe I'm strange. Well, I'm told I'm strange. But I'll be normal someday. All you people will become like me. I'll be the norm.
So, Louise, do we have time for one more reading?
Sure.
Yeah. Now, this one, it begins, she sits on the piano bench. So can you set that up?
Well, let me see. I don't remember the book. That's why I wrote it. So I wouldn't have nightmares.
This is...
Okay.
The, right before this, it seems like it's getting...
Oh, this is a happy thing, almost. Is it?
Yeah. And I think...
God, we're going to have a bright. I don't think I kill anybody here.
Yeah. We want to leave on a high note here.
I kill seven. Well, I'm not perfect.
Right before this, it seems like it's gotten to you. It seems like it's overwhelming you. You come to document the dead. You have a really nice... quote at the beginning of the book about it's from Death of a Salesman, something to the effect of, he may not have been an important person, but we must note his death. And that's what it seems like you...
Attention must be paid.
Yeah.
Linda's speech when Willie Loman dies, you can't pretend he's a dog. Yeah, I read that when I was 15, never forgot it.
So that's what you were trying to do in Sue Aquatis, is to note the deaths, right? So
that's why I wrote the book. I wasn't trying to solve a murder. By the time this thing came out, there's 5,000 dead people. And I didn't plan to write the book. I thought, Jesus, there has to be some record of this, some kind. You can't just pretend, well, I'd rather watch TV, that they're human beings.
And that's what you tell the sicario, isn't it? That you're not... In Juarez to solve crimes, you're there to explain how it works.
I told him I'd never judge him or defend him. I'd try to explain him. When we finished all this, he wanted me to pray with him. No, I'm serious. We embraced and prayed. But he told me an interesting thing. He says, I'm reading the Bible now. And the Bible says... that if you accept Christ, you can be forgiven for all your sins. And he says, I don't think that's possible in my case. He's a very intelligent, honest person. I'm not saying, that he's looking for your forgiveness, but he doesn't think he can be forgiven for what he's done. And I told him I didn't know, I told him I didn't know, Okay.
Who's the she in this passage?
Well, actually, I had to give a speech in a distant city. I'd fled Juarez, kind of a detox. And I ran into this woman there. I was at a big banquet. We're having dinner. And she knew how to play Rhapsody in Blue. And I think Rhapsody in Blue is one of the greatest moments in the history of our country, George Gershwin's composition. And so I said, it was a big private club. And so there's a grand piano in this room, one of the club rooms, and the moon's pouring through. And so she sat down at the piano. She sits on the piano bench, her black hair clean and shining, and she bends over the keys. The moon is full and rides the sky, hunting for more bodies. Two days ago, they killed seven. Yesterday in the afternoon, sometime in October, six went down. Or was it seven? It's getting very hard to keep track of our daily or monthly count. Even the grand total for the year seems like a smear of blood on the wall. No matter how hard I work at my tally, I fall behind. I write down numbers in my black notebook and take a sip of coffee in the dawn light, and before I return the cup to the immaculate white saucer, the number's gone. Juarez, even now as I sit in the room, wine in hand, moonlight playing off the walls, yes, at this very moment, Juarez marauds through my mind. Corpses, ghosts, bullets, knives, severed heads, all manner of carnival moments, a parade from a lively hell, shapeless, formless, and often meaningless. She leans forward, flicking her fingers on the white keys as the rhapsody pumps so much energy and hope into the room. So I sit, a glass of wine in hand, as she strokes the keyboards and plays Rhapsody in Blue. The opening is bold, the bellowing of a young century in a cocksure country. She stumbles on parts and apologizes, but there is no need for such comments. Her plane is beautiful, as her black hair and fair skin glows in the moonlight, washing over the dark room. The moon walks through the window and plays on the white walls. Branches and leaves dance as shadows. It's my therapy moment. You'll be happy to know I'm also a devout bird watcher. I've never seen a flicker. It didn't excite me.
Well, thanks, Charles, for joining us on Aloud. And yeah, there's some microphones out there, so please raise your hand and wait until the microphone gets to you and it's in. Oh, okay. No. So this man here in the black and white shirt, if you could say your name and you know, what your question is.
My name's Randall, and a question to Mr. Bowden?
Bowden, yeah.
Yeah.
Or Chuck.
What is your strategy for staying alive and to report all these things?
Say that again?
What is your strategy for staying alive to report all these things?
I'm a coward. That's my strategy. Look, I report these things because I believe it's my duty, it's my job, even though nobody employs me. But my strategy is to be a coward. If I sense something's off, I leave. Drug dealers taught me a valuable lesson many years ago. You can never be burned by a deal you don't do, you know, that you back out of. And so I plunge and then retreat. I get frightened, you know. Brave reporters get killed. I'm serious, you know.
Do you drink with some of your sources?
Yeah, kind of. You know, doing this book was the only time I've ever relaxed in Juarez. And I'll tell you why. For years, I'd done stories there. I'd get reports from DEA that there's a contract on me or some damn thing. I'd sort of watch my back. I'd shift motels. I wouldn't tell anybody where I was. I'd suddenly appear, disappear. This violence is so general, it's relaxing. It doesn't matter who you are, where you are, what class you are, what you do. You can just go like that. There's no pattern to it. It's like living through a meteor shower. So for the first time, I'll just sit there and have a beer because there's no way to protect myself. I know this sounds bizarre, but I just kick back, you know. The other thing is I'm delusional, as many of you may have sensed. When I start something like this, I don't think if I can find a publisher, the hell with them. I don't give a damn about editors. I think for reasons I can't explain, I'm on a mission. I became 5 months into 2008 when I was convinced what was going on. It wasn't a cartel war. It was many things, but the real thing, it was a breakdown of a city of poverty, that I was going to create a record. And then in an odd way, I couldn't die until I finished it. Then you know, I could be hit by a machine gun or a meteor. So I just became obsessed. That's that simple. Now, there's absolutely no factual basis for this feeling I had. You know, but I believed it, you know. And by God, I've done physical things. If you finish a marathon, you will yourself. You finish it. And so I was in that same state. Turns out, even a fool can be right. Here I am.
All right, let's get another question in. The lady here with the glasses on her head.
Thank you. I have the book. I haven't read it yet. I just finished teaching Heart of Darkness, and I just can't help but think about the man who goes into the jungle and has these horrors.
Yeah, Kurt.
Yeah, and I see you a bit of Marlowe being able to, you've stepped over the edge, but you come back to tell it all. And I guess my question is, will you go back do? I mean, what is your strategies for you're telling this, and what now? I guess is my question.
I don't know. Look, I've been trying never to go back to Juarez for 10 years. I spent 7.5 years writing a book called Down by the River on the interior of the drug world in Juarez and other places. And I thought, I'm never going to deal with this again. I'm tired of dead people. I'm tired of misery. I'm tired of this. And then things happen, like this thing. I'm sitting having coffee in Tucson, Arizona, and they shoot 4 comandantes in about a 30-hour period. And I'm with Julian Cardona, my friend from Juarez, and it's January 20th, 2008, and we both get in our chair, out of our chair, go to my truck, get in it, and drive to Juarez because we knew something was going on we didn't understand. Now, I don't know why, but that's what I do. Now, I'm in deep 12-step now. I'm 300 pages into a book about the lower Mississippi Delta because I thought, this is as far from Juarez as I can get. I'm trying, but I can't promise anything because I think some things have to be written down, you know. And if somebody else had written the book I wrote or something like it, I wouldn't have written it. But as I tried to suggest earlier, and I don't want to sound egotistical or significant, demented I can handle, I was raised in a way that both my parents are dead, my father long dead, and I thought if I don't do this, I can't face them. You know, I can't explain. I'm not a religious person or a spiritual person in that sense. I just thought I'm not going to be able to live with myself because I know what's going on there. I'm not reading it in the U.S. press. I'm not seeing it on CNN and the other bastions of truth. And so I went. That's all I can do. I didn't get paid for this. I didn't go to a publisher and get it advanced. I did this out of my own hide, you know. And I must say it cut into my drinking time. There were sacrifices. But
let's get another question in. Hands. Do I see some hands? There's a hand in the back over there.
Hi, Chuck.
Sure.
There's a current running through the whole book that it seems like you're saying that all these people dying in Juarez is not just because of drug cartels and crooked police and politicians, but you don't come right out and say, but there's this metaphorical notion that it's more just sort of the darkness of the human soul. It's the feeling I got from reading it. And that, you can disagree with that or agree, the real question is, if they legalized drugs in America today, how would that affect the death rate in Juarez a year from now?
Okay. I don't think, you know, I don't say it as darkness of the human soul, because I don't think Mexicans have dark souls or light souls. They're just people like us. I think there's behavior in this city because of what's happening that's barbaric, you know. Look at it. I'll give you the short answer. If you legalize drugs, violence will increase in the short term. Mexico will be bankrupt in the short term. You can't pull the rug out of 50 billion people on a struggling country without a consequence. Do you think these hundreds of thousands of people throughout the country that are in the drug industry are going to say, well, Jesus, I just lost my high-paying job. I'm going to become a Walmart greeter? Yeah, we know what will happen when we ended Prohibition. The boys, the bootleggers, didn't go down to the five and dime and get a day job. They started robbing banks, you know. But what I do think is there is no consequence personally, and I speak as a person who's buried close friends from drugs. There is no consequence of legalization that's as damaging to the American people or the Mexican people as this war. There are no silver bullets, you know. We have a country that uses drugs. It isn't going away. They also drink booze. It isn't going away. We have taken what is at most a public health issue and made it a criminal issue. We treat addicts. If you have a cardiac, you don't say, send me a homicide detective. You want a doctor. Well, we've got addicts, and we send the police. This isn't going to work. Now, I live in a country where there isn't a major politician in this entire country with enough guts to say, let's discuss legalization. And I think that's a disgrace. We have the highest prison population per capita on the planet Earth. You know, we've built a huge police force. We spend 30 to 40 billion a year just on narcotics officers. We have illegal, in my opinion, search and seizure of our vehicles and everything else, because we're trying to tell our fellow citizens what they should ingest. Well, our standard should be what we have on alcohol. You can drink all you want, but if you start driving drunk or attacking people, we throw your ass in jail. You know, that you work out your own damnation, but you have to be nice and polite. You know, just like we let people eat Big Macs. We don't force feed them tofu. That this war has to end, and eventually it will. It will bankrupt us. As a byproduct, and this is not minor, so far 23,000 Mexicans have been slaughtered. The general now running the war says, don't worry, I'll wrap it up in 5 to 10 years. They're going to kill more people than we lost soldiers in Vietnam. And I will guarantee you, the day they say peace is broken out in this war, there will be just as many drugs in this country, and they'll be just as cheap and just as available. Now, why can't this penetrate the heads of political figures? If our drug policy were a ship, they'd call it the Titanic, for Christ's sake. It's time to have a real peace movement. There's a war against poor people in Mexico and chemically dependent people in my own country, and I'm against it. Okay.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for joining us, and we're going to be—he's going to be signing books outside. So please, please join us. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for tolerating me.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Can you sign mine?
Sure.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC, 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.